This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast
with Tony Bruschi.
We are listening to specific segments of testimony from the trial of Lori Vallow-Daybell. We're now back to Utah Medical Examiner Dr. Eric Christensen testifying for the second time in the trial. Let's take a listen.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bailiff. Please be seated. Okay, we're back on the record on case CR 22-21-1624, State of Idaho versus Lori Noreen Vallow. The state's continuing presenting its case in chief during the jury trial. The jurors are all present and accounted for. I believe have all also signed their juror affirmation for the day. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bailiff. Again, thank you to the jurors for your continued service and for continuing to follow that admonishment each day as we break for the day. At this time, the court notes the prosecution is present as well as the defendant and the defense. The witness, Dr. Christensen, was testifying yesterday and was previously placed under oath. I will remind the witness you are still under oath. The state completed its direct examination, and I believe we would be starting this morning with cross-examination. Would that be you, Mr. Thomas?
I'll be doing that, Judge.
All right, Mr. Thomas, if you'd like to start your cross-examination at this time, you may.
Thank you.
Morning, Dr. Christensen.
Good morning.
So, I believe you testified on direct examination that you went to medical school at the University of Virginia, but you didn't really disclose where you did your undergraduate work. Where'd you do that?
I did my undergraduate degree at Brigham Young University.
BYU?
Yes.
Okay. And what year did you graduate from undergrad?
1986.
Okay. And then I believe you said you went to Walter Reed Medical Center. Where is Walter Reed at?
Walter Reed Army Medical Center is in Washington, D.C. That's where I did my internship training in pediatrics.
And at that point, were you a hospital-based pathologist at Walter Reed, or was that somewhere else?
That was subsequent to that. I initially did pediatric training for 1 year at Walter Reed. Then I spent 3 years working for the Army as a flight surgeon and general medical officer. I was also the chief of the Department of Primary Care at Fort Huachuca for 2 years. And then subsequent to that, did training in anatomic and clinical pathology.
So you went into the Army after medical school, is that
right?
Yes. Okay.
Technically before. They paid for medical school. I was a reservist while I was in medical school.
Oh, okay. You described a little bit about what pathology is and that basically you take fluid samples or tissue samples or autopsies and you look at those and try to find if there's any type of disease or natural process or what is it about pathology? Is that right?
Yes, that's a good description.
Okay. And specifically you said in order to become a forensic pathologist, first you have to go through, be a board certified anatomic pathologist?
That's correct.
And what is an anatomic pathologist?
Anatomic pathology is what you train in your regular anatomic and clinical pathology residency. It's learning to diagnose cancers. It's learning to, learning lab medicine and all of those things. But anatomic pathology specifically is focused on the examination of disease in tissues.
Okay. All right. And in this particular case, there was a death certificate that was issued, and you reviewed that death certificate as part of this case study?
I did.
Okay. And what was the findings on the death certificate?
I believe it was the cause of death was certified as cardiac arrest due to pulmonary edema.
Okay. And your findings were inconsistent with that death certificate?
Are different from that, certainly. As I explained yesterday, pulmonary edema is not really a cause per se. You can have pulmonary edema and not die. And it's not it's something that results from multiple causes of death, but it's not something that, without further explanation is an adequate explanation for why a person died.
And you talked a little bit yesterday about pulmonary edema being that frothy substance that was on the outside of her mouth. Is that correct?
Yes, that is one manifestation of it. It's primarily a process in the lungs, but it does sometimes manifest externally like that.
Okay. And are you aware as to whether or not that frothy substance was ever collected and tested?
My understanding was not.
Okay. Is that something that would normally happen?
No.
No. So if somebody's brought into you, into your, what do you call it? It's not a medical clinic, right?
The medical examiner's office.
Medical examiner's office. When somebody's brought into your medical examiner's office and you open up, unzip the bag and they have that frothy substance, does that just get cleaned off and doesn't get tested, doesn't get looked at?
It gets documented in terms of photography. We take pictures of it so that we have documentation that sit there, but there's no testing that would be done on it. I don't know what testing you would do on it.
Well, I guess my thought might be, and I'm most likely wrong. I have been before, and this is not a super exceptional circumstance. But my thought process would be that maybe there were some poisons or something in the frothy substance that might be able to be tested.
I don't know that you could collect enough of it to test. Most lab testing requires minimum sample volumes, usually on the order of at least a milliliter, and usually that froth is not anywhere near that volume that would be there. And there are better samples to use from an autopsy, tissue or blood.
Okay. As part of the autopsy process, is it normal for you to examine the mouth and inside the mouth?
Yes.
And did you do that on this particular case?
Yes.
Even after the embalming process where I think they sew up the mouth. Is that right?
They generally will put a wire through the upper and lower jaw to hold the jaw in place, yes.
Okay. And you remove that and you examine the mouth?
I actually don't recall specifically that, but I would assume so.
Okay.
I don't have a specific recollection of that, but that would be a routine part of the process.
Was that documented in your report?
In the report, no. I would have to look at the photograph. Photographs would probably document that.
Okay. The photographs that we had earlier that were presented to you yesterday didn't show any of that, right?
They did not, no.
Okay. X-rays are generally taken, you indicated. Were X-rays taken on this particular case?
They were.
And was there anything out of the ordinary with those X-rays?
No.
Okay. And when you got to your conclusions as to the cause of death being asphyxia, you explained that asphyxia is basically the when a person is deprived of oxygen. Is that right?
Yeah, inability to, have enough oxygen, inability to breathe normally, yes.
Okay. And you indicated that a couple of those different ways to do that, or three different ways to do that, would be drowning would be an example of asphyxia?
It would.
Mm-hmm. And hanging would be an example of asphyxia?
It could be, yes.
And that there was some sort of a chemical asphyxia, like a carbon monoxide poisoning or something that would inhibit the person being able to breathe?
Yes.
All right. And you also indicated that asphyxia was a diagnosis of exclusion?
Yes.
All right. And so in this particular case, you did X-rays, didn't find anything abnormal. You did internal and external exam, didn't find anything abnormal. Is that right?
Correct.
So, and I may be over, I'm more than likely I am oversimplifying this, but when someone has a seizure, you indicated that it was some sort of a brain response. Is that right? Tell me a little bit about what.
Yeah, a seizure is abnormal electrical activity in the brain that can manifest in a variety of ways.
Abnormal electrical activity in the brain. And so once someone has passed, that brain activity obviously ceases, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And so there's no way to really restart that or to check to see what abnormal electrical issues there are in that particular person, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So kind of like a car, when, you know, you have a car and it has a dead battery, you don't know if there's something wrong with the engine or not because you can't start the car. Does that make sense?
I suppose, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. And so with this particular case, with Tammy's death, you're not sure what happened as far as if there were any seizures, if that caused any type of other electrical abnormalities that could have caused her death, right?
I'm not sure what you mean by unsure. I think it's very unlikely that that happened.
Okay. So. And the unlikeliness of that happening is based on your review of her medical records and her past history?
And clinical medical experience with, you know, that just the nature of new onset seizures in someone of her age, yes.
And when you say nuances of seizures, you indicated that she was on, I believe it was fluoxetine?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And is that a generic version of Prozac?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And isn't it true that Prozac, one of the long-term side effects of Prozac includes seizures?
It probably does.
All right. And so if there's a possibility of seizures as part of her medical regimen, and her husband indicated to the medical examiner, and which was in her reports and whatnot that you reviewed, saying that she had seizures, would that make it possible that she may have passed from a seizure?
Again, there are many things that are possible. I cannot absolutely exclude that she had seizure activity, but I just think it's very, very unlikely.
Okay. But the truth of the matter is that you really didn't do any tests on her, on this dead body, because there was no electrical activity going on in the body.
Right. Well, there are no tests that you can do to document seizures after someone has died, but we did have a neuropathologist examine her brain, which was revealed to be completely normal.
Right. And tell me a little bit about that neuropathologist. Who was that?
His name is Dr. Andrew Guajardo, works in our office.
Okay. And how long has he worked with you?
He's been in our office since 2019.
Okay. And in your experience as a medical doctor and as a pathologist, have you ever worked in this particular field, the neuropathology?
I am not a neuropathologist, no.
Right. But was it part of your study or part of your training?
Yes, it is.
All right. So you knew what he was doing. And did he just explain it to you, or did he show you? I guess I don't really know what he did. Did he take the brain out and slice it open and pull it apart and look
at
it?
Yeah, we remove the brain as part of the examination. We then preserve it in formaldehyde for a period of time, and then he subsequently did an exam for which I was present. And he then, you know, does a thorough examination, takes photographs, and generates a report as well.
Okay, so you saw him do what he did?
Yes.
Did he cut the brain open?
Yes.
Okay, and did he take samples out of that brain?
Yes.
Okay, and from what, whereabout in the brain did he take those?
I would have to review the report. I would imagine from the hippocampus and other places, but I don't know without referencing the report specifically. I don't recall.
Okay, do you have your report with you?
Yes.
Would you like to review that?
If you'd like, sure.
Sure, go ahead.
So he took sections of both hippocampi.
I'm sorry, you can't really review. You can review the report, and then you have to put it back. I'm not trying to be a jerk, but
that's fine.
That's just how it works. So,
he took sections of both hippocampi, of the medulla, of two portions of the cortex of the cerebrum, and the basal ganglia, I believe, and portion of the cerebellum.
Okay. And where would he have been looking for seizure activity in that dissection of the brain?
So he's not looking for seizure activity. What he's looking for in those sections of brain are anatomic abnormalities that are associated with seizures.
Okay. So it's possible that he could have missed something?
Possible.
Okay. And it's possible that she died of a seizure of natural causes, right?
Possible. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything in the medical records that you reviewed or any of the collateral reports that you reviewed that may have talked about Tammy's use of vitamins or essential oils or other homeopathic type remedies?
It was mentioned in a couple of places that she did use those in different ways. I don't have any indication as specifically how she used them. In the photographs that were taken by the coroner at the scene, there were many essential oils and other non-pharmaceuticals that were present at the scene, which we went through and listed and looked up to see what they were.
Right. And so when somebody has a history of using those things, I mean, it's possible to overdose on some vitamins or some essential oils, right, and die from that?
There is nothing you can't overdose on given enough of it, yes.
Okay. Specifically, vitamin A, one of the side effects of overdosing on that is death. Is that right?
Yes, but that's a long, long-term process. I'm not aware of any situation where someone would die acutely from vitamin A toxicity. I've seen that actually before in some people, but it generally is people that take too much for an extended period of time. It leads to liver failure.
Okay. And did you review this for any type of vitamin poisoning?
We didn't see any evidence of it.
Okay.
So, I mean, specifically, we did not test for vitamins, no.
Didn't test for it. Did you test for any essential oils or any essential oil type poisoning?
No, I'm not aware of any testing available for that.
Okay. You did a lot of testing for poisons, right?
Yes.
And that's basically because she had such a, I don't want to say normal, but normal autopsy. I mean, it was hard to find a cause of death, right? That's why you kind of lean towards poisoning, is that right?
That's certainly part of the reason, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. You tested for some heavy metals?
Yes.
And what was the purpose of doing that?
Heavy metal poisoning can lead to death.
Okay. And you specifically sent it to a chemical lab that you have in Utah?
Yes.
What kind of a chemical lab is that?
It's part of the Utah Public Health Lab. It's what they call a chemical threat response lab that is involved in monitoring for both bioweapons and chemical weapons agents, among other things.
Do many states have that?
I actually don't know how many states have that.
Okay. But your state has it, Utah has it. Is that because of the Tula Army Depot and the chemical weapons?
I'm not aware of the history of it or why it's there.
Okay, all right. Then you sent some stuff off to the National Medical Lab Services or National Medical Services Lab in Pennsylvania, is that right?
Correct, yes.
And is that just a big lab that services all over the country?
Yes, it is a reference lab for forensic toxicology testing as well as other clinical testing, and they do some crime lab things as well. I think they do DNA testing. We don't use them for that, but they're a very large forensic toxicology reference lab.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your review of the external body of Tammy Daybell. Some of the bruising was significantly more severe, than some of the other bruises. Is that right?
I don't know that I would characterize it that way.
Okay.
And certainly, you know, some of it in the sections that we reviewed yesterday showed more hemorrhage than other areas, but they are all relatively, you know, superficial, you would say, or, you know, they're tissue injuries, you know, on the, you know, with the surface and the immediate, you know, underneath tissue. They're certainly not in any way a lethal injury or anything of that nature.
So when you say a serious hemorrhage, they weren't, I guess I'm just saying there was one that you looked at that had the surface of the skin And then there was a significant amount of black substance, I'm assuming it's blood,
yes,
underneath that, in that fatty tissue. Is that right?
Yes.
You recall the one that I'm thinking of?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. And some of the other ones that you pulled were more closer to the skin, which means they had less hemorrhaging that went, I guess it went less deep. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. So in order for something like that to happen, would it be consistent with someone falling or hitting something or being hit with something, or would it be more consistent with fingerprints or somebody holding someone down?
Yeah, I think, as I said yesterday, those types of blunt injuries generally are nonspecific as right. to their. There's nothing I can look at any one of those individual injuries or even collectively and say, you know, this is caused by this. You know, they're not specific as to what caused them. I can tell you they're consistent with this or that or the other thing. And to answer your question specifically, could you fall down and sustain a bruise like that? Sure.
Okay. What, if anything, makes them consistent with your cause of death being asphyxia?
Just their location and the number of them and their age by looking at them microscopically.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about the age of these. You said once the area is hemorrhaged and you have that breaking of the blood vessels, then you said that they're is a period of time where nothing happens, and then there's a period of time where white blood cells kind of attack that area. Is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. So tell me a little bit about the attacking of that area to heal the body or whatever. How long does that take?
It can begin as quickly as a couple of hours. It can take a day or more in some cases, and there's not really any way to know exactly where on that spectrum any individual injury is. But until you see inflammatory cells, you know that at most you're looking at several hours.
And when you looked at these particular, I can't remember what you called them. Did you call them slides, or what did you call them?
Slides is what I ended up looking at. Yes.
Okay. And you looked at them underneath a microscope.
That's correct.
Okay. And there was no cell activity where it looked like they were trying to. The white cell activity looked like it was trying to heal.
No, there was no inflammatory response in any of them.
Inflammatory response. Okay. You specifically talked a little bit about the time of death and how you really couldn't estimate the time of death. The prosecutor asked you if this would be consistent with happening prior to if the call was made at 6 o'clock, prior to 5:40 a.m. And you really couldn't give us a definite answer on when this time of death was, right?
Well, I believe I said specifically that it's unlikely to have occurred, you know, around 5:30 or close to the time of her discovery if she's already stiff at that time.
Okay.
But beyond that, is it 1 hour, 3 hours, 5 hours, 10 hours? I can't tell you.
Okay. So it's possible that the Tammy had been lying dead in her bed for a number of hours prior to her discovery?
That's certainly possible.
Okay. Did you happen to review in your study of this particular case a forensic pathology report from Raven Pathology Associates?
Yes, I believe I did.
Okay. In that particular report, she had a different result than what you had, right?
I believe so, yes.
I'd like to show that if the witness, what we've marked as defendants, I believe E.
I'll just withdraw it.
I'm going to withdraw that question, Judge.
Okay.
All right. Okay, no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Thomas. Redirect examination?
Just briefly, Your Honor.
Very well.
Dr. Christensen, you were asked if your findings differed from that of the original death certificate or the coroner. They, in fact, did differ, correct?
They did.
And is part of that because the cause of death listed on that certificate is not actually a cause of death?
It's not an explanation for why someone would die, yes.
But you did, in fact, see signs of pulmonary edema, is that correct?
We did, yes.
So in that sense, that at least that finding was similar. It's just the coroner had listed that is the cause of death when, in fact, that is not the cause.
Correct. I mean, she might have listed, as she did, cardiac arrest due to pulmonary edema, but then it would require an additional line of explanation due to something else, due to heart failure, due to drowning, due to drug overdose, due to asphyxia, whatever. It's pulmonary edema is an insufficient explanation for why someone died.
And similar with cardiac arrest, and I'm going to forget the terminology that you used yesterday, but they are essentially a symptom or a result of the actual cause of death.
Correct.
And I think we talked about this yesterday as well, but a coroner is very different from a medical examiner or forensic pathologist, correct?
Just in training, yes. Mm-hmm.
But you have significantly more training?
With respect to death investigation, yes.
And coroners are not required to attend medical school?
No.
They're not required to attend all the training that you attended?
No.
In addition to that, coroners, generally speaking, do not perform autopsies?
They do not in most cases.
And in performing the autopsy, does that assist in your determining a cause of death?
It does.
Does it assist in your determining the manner of death?
It does.
You did, I think you've previously testified, you've been asked a lot today by defense about seizures and if that could be a potential cause. I believe you testified yesterday when you're looking at a negative autopsy, there are a limited number of causes that you're generally looking into.
That's correct.
Okay. And again, one of those causes could be seizures.
Yes.
Can you go over again why in this case did you determine that the seizure was unlikely, or what exactly was your determination with regard to seizures?
Sure. So with respect to seizures, in the setting of a negative autopsy, the most normal finding in a brain, for example, of somebody with known seizures, is a normal brain. So if I have somebody come to my office with known seizures who has died in their sleep or has died of a witness seizure or something like that, when I look at their brain, most of the time, most people with idiopathic epilepsy have normal brains. So a normal brain in and of itself does not exclude seizures as a possibility, and she certainly had a normal brain. However, the primary things in this case that I think in my mind have mitigated against seizure as a possible cause of her death are her age and lack of history. It was discussed that there was some, you know, recent history perhaps of seizures, but I could find no indication that that had been evaluated, looked at medically, or in any way was concerning enough to have evaluated. New onset seizures with a normal brain in a 49-year-old is quite unusual.
And you were also asked about intoxicants. Is that, and again, just for the benefit of the jury, that is one other cause of death that could result in a negative autopsy?
It is.
And in this case, I believe you said you did, or there was one of the most extensive tests testing procedures done that you've ever been involved in?
Yes.
And I believe you were asked, did you consider potentially that this was a death from some kind of an intoxicant?
Yes, I mean, certainly that's one of the reasons we did all the testing we did. We were concerned that it was. And I think, as I mentioned yesterday, there's not an ability ever to totally exclude any possible substance, simply because the amount of testing that would be required to do that would be generally more than you even have samples to do the testing for. But the testing that we did excludes, you know, hundreds and hundreds of possible substances, both, as I said, you know, over-the-counter, illicit, and therapeutic medical substances, as well as a number of other toxins. And could there be something else? Certainly. It's just very, very unlikely given the amount of testing that was done.
And in this particular case, you did rule out intoxicants as a likely cause of death. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what was the reason for that?
Just, again, the exhaustive nature of the testing that was done, and no indication that there was something else that we hadn't covered.
And you were asked about those bruises again, and again, for the benefit of the jury, in looking at them and taking the samples, what were you able to determine with regard to a time of when those may have been inflicted?
So, yes, they are acute injuries, again, with no inflammatory response, meaning they have occurred, you know, sometime from right around the time of death to as many as several hours beforehand. But generally, it would be very, very unusual for them to be more than a day and quite unusual for them to be more than 12 hours old with that finding.
And while you can't say for sure, did those bruises appear to be consistent with someone being restrained?
They are certainly consistent with that.
And the autopsy is just one part of the investigation you conduct, is that correct?
That is correct.
So part of your investigation and your expert opinion is based on external information provided?
It is.
You were asked again a little bit about the time of death, and did you review information regarding when the death was reported?
Yes.
And did you review information regarding what was reported in relation to the state of Tammy's body at that time?
I did.
And was the information you reviewed that she was cold and stiff?
Yes.
What would that lead you to believe as far as how far before the call she may have passed away?
Sure. So there are two parts to that. You know, the cold part, you know, if a body has cooled substantially, a person who's interacting with that body, we are used to interacting with each other at normal body temperature. And so any substantial decrease in a person's temperature is going to be perceived as cold. And whether that's, you know, a few degrees or 20 degrees or whatever it is, it's really difficult to you know, draw many conclusions from just an assessment of cold other than that they have probably been dead for a while and their circulation has stopped. And so putting a time on that is not really possible based on cold. Based on stiff, again, rigor mortis is a process that develops over time. It's generally not there at all. When a person first dies, they remain flaccid for a period of time and then become stiff in the ensuing 1 to 2 hours generally is when it starts and will stiffen further to the point of where they're maximally stiff somewhere usually around 12 hours, and then that stiffness will persist until the body begins to decompose. So to answer your question, generally, if someone is described as stiff, again, that can be a variable thing, but at a minimum, at least an hour probably has passed since the person died.
And you were asked if she could have been laying there dead.
Yes.
In your experience, or would you be able to determine, would you expect a dead person to roll out of bed?
Not without some external force applied. So there are a number of scenarios that I've seen over the years where a dead body has moved. Generally speaking, that is in the setting of decompositional changes, where the body is actually changing shape and configuration because of bloating and other postmortem changes. That does not happen in the early postmortem period. And a person who is, you know, recently deceased would not be expected to move on their own without the application of some other external force.
And again, based on the autopsy and then the investigation you conducted, what did you determine to be the cause of death?
Asphyxia.
I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Blake. That will conclude the testimony then of this witness. Let me inquire of the state, is the witness allowed to be released from any subpoena?
Yes, Your Honor, we would request he be released.
We have no objection.
All right, with no objection from the defense then, Dr. Christensen, thank you for your testimony. You can be excused. The bailiff will help assist you out of the courtroom.
This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast
with Tony Bruschi.
That's Utah Medical Examiner Dr. Eric Christensen testifying for the second time in the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell. We have far more on this case and much more. You can follow all the cases that we're covering for you just by subscribing here on the Hidden Killers podcast. Or if you want to follow cases specifically, there's links in the episode descriptions to follow specific channels that we have for you. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.